Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 55 for April 2015. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we get people from different places in the world to tell us how things are going in their quadrant of the planet and what things are important in their neighborhood and possibly how they look at things that are important in other parts of the world, hopefully giving us a somewhat global view of the news in the world. Ooh, something's firing up. I heard Skype, and that was Skype on the Western portion of the show. It was sounding off from Tom Merritt's computer. And I'm hoping, I think so. Or maybe
I heard it too, but I don't know why that would be happening.
Huh.
Or where Eric, it would be coming from.
No. Eric, are you still there? No. Ooh.
Who smelt it, dealt it.
To Western Europe is what you were trying to say.
That's where I was going.
So, yeah, I know. I heard it. I think I heard it in my house, too. So I think you're right. But I'm not sure what computer it was.
You have too many of those. Maybe a phone or something.
Apologies for that.
So that lovely voice is that of Tom Merritt, as I was saying, a podcaster extraordinaire. In some ways, my boss, since I work for him on the Daily Tech News Show, his Daily Tech News Show, which is very aptly named. How are you? And you are in California, in Los Angeles. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm on the west side of Los Angeles. Actually, the patrons of Daily Tech News Show are both of our bosses.
That's so true.
That means you work for me.
That's right. Exactly. Eric's our boss.
My $1 a month really buys a lot of power.
Hey, man, it helps. Believe me.
Every little bit.
Yeah. No, things are sunny in Los Angeles. It's 8 in the morning, and we're all awash in the glow of last night's interview with Diane Sawyer by Bruce Jenner.
Okay, I don't know who any of those people are, but
awash would imply that you have some water, so you don't have any water. But other than that, everything's fine.
It's a sand bath, but yeah.
That's right.
And so, by the way, by your Patreon logic, you're also my boss because you're a boss of Rendezvous Tech. So, in a way, you are my boss.
It's a very intricate org chart.
And Eric Olander is here as well, all the way from Vietnam. And Eric, you sent me your official nomenclature for...
Well, it's all so confusing for everybody, so I figure I always send this thing out in advance so people can read from it.
Yeah, that was very... Because I could not have come up with this on my own. So you're the general director of FBNC, which is the All Business News Cable TV network in Vietnam. And you're also the co-founder of the China-Africa Project and the co-host of the weekly China in Africa podcast, which is something you were doing when you were still working in France at another TV channel when I first met you.
Yeah, so that's been going on for 5 years now. I'm nowhere near as successful a podcaster as you two are, so one of these days you're going to have to tell me your secrets on how to kind of get into the big leagues of it all.
Basically, fool people into giving you money and do it all day. So
nice.
That's
hey,
how
good.
It works.
Fool people to give me money. Got it.
Got it down? Good. That's it.
Excellent. So I had you two on the show. We were joking before we started recording that when I already had you two together on the show, and that was because when I was looking at the previous episodes, I was thinking, well, it might be time to get some serious people, some real journalists back on the show. And of course, your
you couldn't find any.
Who else is coming? Yeah, really.
But yeah, so it's about 8 a.m. for you, Tom, I believe.
Yeah,
it's
that's right.
5 p.m. for me and 10 p.m. for you, Eric. So we're spanning the globe once again.
So and, no good morning Vietnam jokes this time.
Right.
I didn't even think of this, but okay. It might be appropriate for the topic you're going to cover. And so like I did, as I did for the previous episode, I don't think there's really one main overarching global story to bring us all together on this during the month. There wasn't one. So what we're going to do it as we did last episode, which I thought worked and does give us a slightly more global view of important events in that sense that we're each going to be selecting one, maybe two stories that were making the most noise in our neighborhood. And that might be a local story. It might be a global story, but that's the one we're going to be talking about and potentially comment on each other's stories. So that's the new way of handling the show, which hopefully will work this time again. And for my story, I kind of wanted to select, maybe we'll go with both. They're going to be relatively short. I hope I'm not going to eat up the entire show. But we're going to talk very quickly a little bit about the mass surveillance laws that are being voted on in France right now. And mainly not because it's taking a lot of airtime, although it is taking some airtime, but mostly because it's a topic that we all care about. And I suspect, given our listenership, tech topics are topics that they will care about as well. But before that, I think the main story, the thing that has been making the most noise in France, for sure, is the issue of refugee boats in the Mediterranean. And the fact that a lot of mostly Syrian migrants fleeing the war, basically, and the horribleness in the Middle East have been embarking on very unsafe boats with very scummy operators who are taking a lot of money and promising they will get over to the sacred land of Europe and basically not only escape their country torn by tragedy, but also hopefully make a life for themselves in Western Europe. And I'm saying scummy because some of the most terrible details that have come out are about how immoral, I think it's safe to use that term here, immoral they are. And comments like, you know, we had too many of those, so we had to throw a few of them off the boat. And of course, when the boats either sink or don't hold everyone because they're overloaded, a lot of people die, which is, it's not a joke at all, obviously. It's a real tragedy here as well. And there, the sense of tragedy is amplified by the fact that they're trying to flee an already terrible place, and some of them are finding death in the waters that are supposed to be bringing them to the Western Europe where they're hoping to achieve things. Now, the other side of this is that Europe has been, I don't know if you can ever do enough for those problems, but definitely this has raised alarms and people have been realizing that this has been happening for a long time. One of the key things was that in one of those instances, there was a dozen people who were thrown off board because they were Christians. It was actually a religious question there. And that, I think, sort of initiated the whole discussion about this. And it obviously went beyond the question of whether or not they were Christians and started the discussion about all of this issue. But the thing about Europe is that, okay, so to put it very bluntly, the main issue is nobody wants them. And when I'm saying nobody, I'm not saying every you know, citizen in European countries or in Western Europe countries, but the governments, nobody wants them. And each one is sort of saying, yeah, but we can take that many people, but not more because of our situation. Because what do you do with them once they're here? Of course, you can offer them shelter and comfort, but then they're in societies that are already obsessed with the issue of illegal immigration and unemployment, and you know, all of this is already a constant source of political debate here, and no one is stepping up and saying, you know what, we'll just take more or we'll take them. And they're discussing how to, basically the discussion has been going towards how can we prevent these things from happening, maybe by destroying the illegal traffickers, because that's what they are, destroying their facilities rather than figuring out how to get the migrants and the refugees into a safe environment. And I always try to be very unbiased in these descriptions. And I think this, what I'm saying here might imply that the humane thing to do would be to get all of them in a safe, you know, to save them from their situation. Obviously, it's not that simple because we already have issues with immigrants and we haven't found a way of providing them with long-term solutions already. Now, the situation here, I think, is a little bit different because it's actually war refugees and people who are not just leaving a country where they have a bad economic situation to try and find a better situation in Western Europe, but they're actually, a lot of them, or probably most of them, are in actual danger in their country of origin. So it's a difficult situation, and we're nowhere near a solution because the one thing that comes to your mind if you're a human person would be, well, let's just open the doors and get them here. But no one is willing to do that because of what happens afterwards, and no one knows what to do with them afterwards. So definitely that issue of refugee boats and people dying by the dozen in the Mediterranean has been a somewhat difficult, but also it's brought a little bit of a feeling of shame in the discussion in that sense. So that's been occupying the headlines for a few weeks now. And I'm wondering if you guys have heard about it or if it's really a European-centric issue or Middle Eastern-centric issue.
I'm always following European news, so I don't know if it's because of that or more than the fact that I don't know whether it's really being covered in the United States much. But it is interesting to hear your description of it because it's different from the perspective I've gotten just reading about it, which and it's not to contradict anything you say, but the way I have seen it presented mostly by the BBC is that there was the move last year to reduce the operation to rescue the boats coming over. And they don't say Syria only, but they talk about Libya and Eritrea and other places as well, because they felt they were encouraging these risky ventures and that was causing more deaths because people thought, well, we'll go ahead and get on the boat because then someone from Italy will come and save us. And so they reduced the operations, and now it turns out, well, the boats haven't stopped, but you have more of them running into trouble. And you had the recent one where the captain ran into a rescue boat and it killed a lot of people. And then there was finding out that people were locked down into the hold. And that is the kind of thing you're talking about, where they just treat people like cattle. A lot of times it's not even refugees going to a camp. They're people being sold into service in various parts of Europe. And so it has looked as if the conversation is more about, should we be rescuing the boats? Should we be carrying out an operation to rescue boats? Because it might encourage more of them to come. But if we don't carry out this operation at a higher level, then more people are going to die.
That's, you know, it's interesting. I haven't quite heard the discussion on that level in France, at least. And I suspect that it might be different in... I know you listen to the BBC. Get your news from the BBC a lot. I wouldn't be surprised if it was happening on a different level in the UK. I'm sure this has been part of the discussion in France as well, but it certainly hasn't been the main angle on the issue. I think there is a feeling in France that by at least a portion of the population or maybe the political spectrum, that it is our duty to welcome people who need help.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, okay. Marine Le Pen and the Front National and the National Front. Well, no, but that represents a growing slice of the French population. And I think what to look at this in my view, the appropriate context is we back up from the immigration itself and look at the political context with which this is happening in. And there is nowhere in Europe right now today, from Germany to Holland to even Sweden, who has been traditionally one of the more open countries, but particularly France, that can politically sustain a mass wave of immigrants coming in, because there's just no appetite for it among the people. And so I think in some ways we're probably going to see a policy emerge that is similar to what we saw in Australia. And I think Australia represents a very interesting kind of comparison, because Australian political values are very similar to, say, European political values, more in line with them than, say, the United States. And in Australia, they made a policy because they were being flooded with immigrants coming from Indonesia and from Malaysia and from some of these other parts of Southeast Asia. And they basically said, if you arrive by ship, there's no chance you're going to get any, you don't get in, period. We're going to intercept you, you get put to a remote island, and then you get deported back again. I think Frontex, which is the European Union's border service, is probably going to have a policy like that. Which basically does interceptions. Now the French, I think, want to or have started bombing some of the ships. They're trying to blow up the ships before they even leave in Libya and some other places like that.
The empty ships, just to be clear.
That's right. Yes. But at the same time, that's not going to solve the problem. I mean, that is a short-term kind of solution, because they will always create more ships and more. They'll find a way around that. My guess is you're probably going to see a militarization of the Mediterranean to intercept, much like what we have on the U.S.-Mexican border, which has been much more heavily militarized over the past 20 years to stop, and really has been very effective at slowing the flow of illegal immigration. But there is no political appetite in Western Europe for more assimilation, more immigration that I can see right now. And it plays very well into Marine Le Pen. Everything that's happened over the past year, from the Charlie Hebdo to now this, really, really suits the right wing in Europe.
So I would definitely agree with that. And actually, for a few weeks, I was considering discussing the Front National, our far right party, which is gaining a lot of importance, as one of my stories as well. I think there is very little appetite, you're right, for this kind of thing for rescuing and for a wave of welcoming illegal immigrants, or making them legal in a way, because of the right wing rising in Europe. But that's why I was saying some portion of the political spectrum would think that it would be the natural thing to do. It probably means more the people than the elected people. In that sense, that we've always had a very strong tradition of left-wing parties in France and left-wing supporters who were very uncomfortable without even mentioning the Front National, but they were very uncomfortable with the steps that the right-wing party, the Conservative Party, took when Sarkozy was in office in order to curb the issues of illegal immigration. Already at that point, there was a portion of the population that was expressing very strong discontent with those steps that were a lot more mild than what the Australian government has been doing, apparently. So yes, it's a very difficult position to be in for the current government, for sure, at least in France. And I'm sure they can't do what their own base would want them to do in an ideal world, because it would play into the Front National's base. So yeah, I just want to express the fact that there is a portion of the population that would want to get them in, I'm sure, but it just can't happen for a lot of reasons. I think arguably one of them being reality, and that, you know, is arguable, but it's not just political. There is a reason why these things are not working. But yeah, so
I don't know. Front National may end up just being a detail of history.
I see what you did there.
But it also, I think it represents a broader strain of frustration, much like the Tea Party in the U.S., which is just born of frustration.
Or UKIP. I totally hear what you're saying.
You know, but again, I look at this as a pan-European issue, which is France being one, but at the same time, you know, my in-laws live in Holland, and in rural Holland, there is no appetite for any of this, particularly for the fact that they're coming from Muslim countries, which even complicates the issue even more for Europeans who have a tortured relationship with Islam now.
Well, there was an election in Finland only a couple of weeks ago, maybe not even that, a week ago, and their far-right party, the True Finns, is now the second party in the country. And they have, it's funny, last episode I talked about my wife a lot. Bye, honey.
And there she goes.
and cue the wife.
And I talked about my wife a lot, which prompted a couple of comments about me being like Columbo or something, which I appreciate. And she's always laughing about her country's concern with immigration, because basically they have no immigrants. Finland, you know, you can walk around in, or at least no visible immigrants, meaning no people of color almost. You can walk around in Helsinki for hours and not see a black person or a person of Arab origins. And they are still very concerned with all of this, which, if anything, supports your, I don't want to say theory, your statement that this is a concern.
Skepticism that Europe will respond to this in a kind of positive, constructive way. I have a feeling that fear is very much a part of going to drive the policy.
I don't know that there is a constructive way, though.
Well, it is difficult to know what the constructive way to respond would be, because you have the captain of that ship that sunk earlier this week saying, I wasn't even the captain. They just kind of thrust me in there. And maybe that's not true. Maybe he's trying to get out of responsibility. But you definitely have people in Libya and elsewhere who don't care about the fate of the human beings they're putting on these ships once they go across the water. And at that point, how do you discourage that behavior? If you say, like, well, we're not going to allow you to get to shore, the people who are trafficking the humans don't care whether they get there in the first place anyway.
And that's the issue as well, because if you don't discourage it, if you start saying, all right, we'll just, you know, we'll do the right thing and we'll just get all the ones that get on boats and that get to this part of the sea and just welcome them and shelter them and do, you know, the humane thing once again, then obviously it's going to encourage it. And there is no way of saying how it's going to stop.
Which is why I think you'll probably end up with an Australian-like policy, which is mass interceptions, heavily militarized, moving beyond the kind of peace, you know, the types of ships that they have out there right now are more humanitarian types of facilities.
Right.
I suspect what you're going to, as you're going to confront, as Tom rightly pointed out, we're talking about human traffickers who oftentimes are, closely related to narco traffickers and whatnot in that same kind of vein. And so they're armed, this is a business for them. So just the coyotes who bring over immigrants from Mexico or Central America into the United States, they don't care about their cargo. They just want to get money. And I suspect you'll probably have a mass interception, because that's what the European people are going to want. The European people are not going to want wave after wave of North Africans and Syrians to come into their countries. I don't see any appetite for it. So it will be politically expedient and politically popular to embark on, in my view, on an interdiction policy.
Do you think that actually stops the traffickers? I mean, it definitely could stop the problem of the immigrants arriving.
It forces the price up. And again, we have a lot of models, out there. So it forces the price up for trafficking. So it makes it more expensive to go because it will never fully get rid of it. Just like, you know, drug enforcement never fully gets rid of the drugs, but it does make it more difficult. It will force, just like when the U.S.-Mexico border became more difficult to cross, the cartels, they went around and they found other ways to get in. So there will always be a human trafficking problem in Europe, but at least this part of the problem may go away. The key problem here, and this is what I think offends the European sensibilities much more than anything else, unlike Central American migrants coming into the U.S. who are largely economic migrants, largely, not exclusively, but largely, these are war refugees. And so where do you send them back to? Do you send them back to Syria? And I think that's the real difficulty here is, what do you do? Where do you put them? Libya now is a mess. I mean, so even repatriating back to Libya, that's not a sustainable solution either. So I think this is where the European view of human rights and of human dignity will clash with the practical politics that are on the ground.
Well, I think apparently at least, you know, Paris and London are going to start talking to the UN Security Council. So I'm wondering if they're not trying to pass the hot potato around. But we'll see. So is it being just very, very quickly, is it being discussed in Vietnam? I guess it's worlds away.
No. And it's,
right.
No. It's not being discussed in Vietnam simply because it's really not that relevant of a story. But what's interesting is that my earliest impression of Vietnam, which was back in the 1990s when I was living in Hong Kong, was Vietnam was exporting people and refugees all throughout Southeast Asia. I remember in Hong Kong, they were called the boat people, and they were showing up all over, and they were being forcibly repatriated. So this is a story that if you talk to most Vietnamese, they will be able to relate to and connect to, because the 1990s were a brutal period in this country's history.
You know, boat people is a term that's still being used in France to describe these kinds of migrants. So
yeah, I remember in the 80s, there were a lot of stories about the boat people, mostly from Vietnam, Eric. And in fact, we had a family, the Toes, came to our little town of 5,000 people in southern Illinois because they were, you know, there was a big program to settle people and try to find them places to live all throughout the country.
Yeah, so I think you'll find a lot, if you actually brought up this story to a lot of people here, they would be able to relate to it and connect to it in a very personal way.
All right, let's move on to another fun story, the story of mass surveillance being voted into law in France, which I am very much against. And the way I describe it is mass surveillance. It would not please the officials proposing those texts and
it is merely metadata collection, Patrick.
Basically, what they're saying is that they want to install, we've talked about this in various shows, so I'm hoping people are aware of this, but just in case, the main element of the laws I have an issue with is the fact that they want to have what they call themselves black boxes being installed in internet service providers' server farms and other service providers' servers to capture all of the metadata, in some cases more than metadata. I mean, it's still a little bit obscure. We don't know how long it would be retained for, and there would be some kind of algorithm that would analyze the data, which sites everyone goes to and who they get in touch with in order to isolate and target potential terrorists from the entirety of the population. And there are a myriad of reasons why this would not work. And I think I've never seen any example of a law where everyone except the people proposing it, everyone is saying either they're against it or it wouldn't work as they think it would. And that includes, you know, the experts, the people that know tech, the people that that are in charge of protecting our freedoms, like everyone. But obviously with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and only a few days ago, there was apparently a terror attack that was thwarted in the country, And that was basically one guy saying he would want to do something, and maybe like it was a complete by chance that they got him because they were tracking someone else. That it's a mess. But what's sure is that they've played it up like nobody's business. And, you know, it's a communication. I'm not saying the story is not real, but it's certainly being played up. It feels like it's being played up a little bit more than it would have if the law wasn't also being discussed at the moment. And I don't want to get into it too much because I get very angry, but that is something that is being discussed now. And I'm curious, again, if you heard of it, outside of me yelling about it. Maybe Tom is the most likely person.
Well, yeah. I mean, I obviously heard about it because my job is to look at tech news every day. So it came up, and obviously you brought it up on the show. But the interesting thing from the U.S. perspective is the fact that it's generally treated in the U.S. tech blogs as a side note. Hey, we've all been dealing with this in the U.S. for a long time, and I guess France is now too. But they miss, or maybe not even miss, but they avoid the point that, unlike the U.S., where there was a secret surveillance plan that was only revealed after Edward Snowden leaked documents about it, France is doing this above board. They're coming out and saying, here's how we're going to spy on you folks, and still getting it passed.
Well, that's only recent, Tom, though, because the French country, and I think the U.S. tech blogs are pretty unsophisticated in how they deal with other countries for the most part, particularly France. France doesn't have a Fourth Amendment. And so what offends the U.S. sensibility so much is that what the U.S. has been doing is in direct contravention of the Fourth Amendment of illegal search and seizure. Whereas in France, because they don't have that, police powers are much broader. Going back years, the French intelligence services have had the authority to do things that the Americans have never been able to do. And so the French have been operating in this legal gray area for a very, very long time. Not suggesting that what they've done is actually above board. You know, Patrick, I remember back when I was at France 24, there was that big attack in Toulouse. Do you remember about 3 or 4 years ago, there was the attack? The way that the French secret security services found him was through data. They found through text messaging and whatnot. And again, they could never have done that above board in the United States because they didn't need court orders. They didn't. They went right through into the phone networks to find the breadcrumbs back to the data networks.
Are you sure they didn't get court orders to do all of this? I wouldn't be so sure.
My understanding was they didn't. They were working under the national security kind of. They had a blanket kind of immunity to go right through. They found them within 72 hours. And it was a very, very quick. And the point is that they can do things in France that you couldn't do in the U.S. And I think that that's been complicated for the French because they have been able to, ramp up their abilities without the law keeping up with them. What I just find repulsive about this law is how they're ramming it through in a three-day kind of debate. This is so fundamentally important, and it's just being shoved down the throat of the Parliament and the Assemblée Nationale, which I think is just absurd. This is too important.
The police powers, why do they need the law at all then? Is it just to get the patina of appropriateness?
So I think, here's my conspiracy theory that I came up with a couple of days ago. They are trying to legalize a lot of practices that have been illegal, but that they have been doing for a long time. This mass surveillance thing is only one aspect of the laws that are being voted on. And I suspect that they are making this one so outrageous that is it focuses all the attention on it. And they kind of know what it is. I think a lot of the elected people in the parliament, how do you call that in English?
The members of parliament?
Right. The members of parliament don't understand the technical aspects of it and only see, well, we have terrorism, we have to do something about it, let's do this. And the government is apparently pushing for it. And the right can't really say, no, we don't want to, do things against terrorism because that's their bread and butter. So everyone is happy to go along with it. But I'm wondering if, so just a few days ago, President Hollande said that he would submit the law to the Constitutional Council. And I'm guessing they might have things to say about the law. They're also amending it here and there. So I'm guessing that they're expecting, ultimately, by the time it gets actually voted on and voted into law, it's going to be a little bit more tame than what they initially proposed. However, all of the other portions of the law that no one is looking at, because this one is so outrageous, are, well, not being looked at. And they are legalizing a lot of things that have been happening before that no one is investigating so much because, again, all of the attention is on that other one. So that is my conspiracy theory, which honestly I'm not really believing in myself, but I'm thinking might be possible. Because it's so outrageous, it's so ridiculous, it's so big that my conspiracy mind is going to the place where there's something more to this. But I don't know. I guess we'll see. And we'll have results about this soonish, I suspect.
Just because you're paranoid, Patrick, doesn't mean they're not after you.
Exactly. I'm just hoping the Constitutional Council just says something about it and just doesn't just rubber stamp it, but we'll see. Let's go to the U.S. What's been happening for you, Tom?
I always say when I'm on the Phileas Club, I am a very bad consumer of U.S. news since I don't consume it. But I made a special effort on your behalf to pay attention to Fox News, NPR, and USA Today over the last few days. And really, the big serious story that is in the news right now has to do with the ongoing coverage, and I know Eric identified this as well, with the way the police are treating minorities. And the current case is Freddie Gray in Baltimore, who died of a spinal injury while in custody. And there's a lot of confusion about how the spinal injury happened and why it happened and why he was arrested, et cetera. They haven't even released the details of why Freddie Gray was arrested, but it's one of a series that goes back to last summer in St. Louis in Ferguson, when, of course, you had the shooting of a suspect and the controversy around that. That said, that is not the thing that is dominating the U.S. news today. The thing that is dominating the U.S. news today was the interview with Bruce Jenner on ABC's 2020 last night.
Is that still his name, by the way?
It is for now.
He's not Sarah Jenner?
Not yet. Okay. It's a very pertinent question. if anybody doesn't know, Bruce Jenner is a gold medalist from the 1976 Olympics. He won the decathlon. It was back in the era of the Cold War, defeating the Soviets, etc.
He's a Kardashian.
That is the next bit. It's like fast forward from 1976 to the modern day. He's no longer the face of the Wheaties box. He's the face of the guy in the Keeping Up with the Kardashians reality show. So he appeals to a broad set.
Okay, sorry. Just wait a second.
The United States.
Tom, yeah. I'm not getting those references. Why is he a Kardashian?
He was married to the mother of Kim Kardashian.
Okay, and he had a sex change operation? Is that the thing?
You're jumping ahead of the story here.
Okay. Sorry, I don't know.
It has been rumored that he is going to have a sex change operation. He is definitely transgendered. That was the big headline that you just blew for me, Patrick.
I apologize. It's
yesterday, sorry. He sat down with Diane Sawyer, who is a respected journalist here in the U.S. From ABC, and said, "I am a woman." Now, up until now, all of the coverage has been very much sensationalistic. Even ABC's promotion of this has been sensationalistic. Bruce Jenner is going to become Bridget Jenner, apparently. And, why is this happening? And is it just publicity? He's going to do a reality show for E! About changing into a woman. Is this all just a stunt? And I have to say, I watched the interview. It was a 2-hour interview with Bruce Jenner last night, and Diane Sawyer and her team did an excellent job of not covering Bruce Jenner's transgender issues particularly, but covering the issue of being transgender and using Bruce Jenner's story to illustrate it. And I was incredibly pleased. It is the best bait and switch that I have seen in U.S. journalism in a long time.
Positive one.
Exactly, where they got everyone to tune in for the titillating Kardashian sex change bit, and they did a tutorial in what it means to separate your sex from your gender. They even at one point, you know, quoted a prominent expert in the field saying, "Sex is the body you go to bed with, and gender is the body you go to bed as," or I'm getting the quote wrong now, so it obviously didn't stick with me very well. But in other words, they educated the U.S. public yesterday about the issue of transgenderism, and I think they changed a lot of minds. They got a lot of people to actually understand the issue from a very human point of view and stop just laughing about, oh, it's that gold medalist who's doing a stunt.
So how is the, well, I was going to say, how is the U.S. reacting to the issue of gay marriage? And I'm taking a step back in the whole debate.
But those aren't necessarily related in that. I mean,
sure, right. Not, and that was actually one of the...
Homosexuality, sure, and transgender don't have an automatic link.
And no, but I'm guessing
they hammered yesterday on the show where they said, but you've been with women. And he's like, and I'll still be with women. I'm not gay. I'm a woman. And then she's like, well, are you a lesbian? He's like, it's the wrong question.
Patrick, what I think is interesting to see the American kind of reaction to this, and I think this is fascinating for me, is, again, there's been a cultural shift that's been underway for 20 years now, both about homosexuality and gay marriage, which we now see as pretty much standard. The Supreme Court is expected this summer to put the official stamp on it and say this is now a done deal. But when it comes to transgender issues, think back over the past 20 years as well. We've had Chaz Bono, we've had Chelsea Manning, we've had, you know, even I just learned today, one of the Wachowski brothers who did the Matrix,
Wachowski
is transgender.
Yeah.
And I think what's so fascinating is that if you see the list of media personalities who've gone through this, there isn't this kind of, you know, what you would expect, this kind of shock and revulsion or kind of horror. People are generally greeting it as, okay, sure, yeah. Well, okay.
So that is actually the reason why I was asking the question about gay marriage. And I understand that they're, you know, not the same thing. But I'm guessing, and tell me if I'm wrong, I'm guessing that the people who would be quote unquote against gay marriage would also be the people who are shocked by the idea of a transgender person. So that's why, you know, on the scale of acceptability to people who are unaccepting of those things, I'm guessing if people can accept gay marriage, then they're that step closer to accepting transgender as a concept. And
yeah. The most recent poll numbers I can find, 63% of U.S. surveyed in a CNN ORC poll supported gay marriage as a constitutional right.
How much? 63%,
yeah.
That's significant.
And the way they ask the question, do you support the freedom to marry as a constitutional right? 63% support that. There are others above that who don't support it as a constitutional right, but would support civil unions, et cetera. So really, the majority of the U.S. is fine with this now. And so I think it is interesting that gay marriage is now sort of fading
normalized as
a controversial issue.
Yeah, it's normalized.
And exactly. And it paves the way to actually confront the issue of transgender, and which just happened last night in a way that I did not expect. No disrespect to Diane Sawyer, but I did not expect 2020 to give me a tutorial on what it means. I expected it to be a fairly standard interview.
Yeah. You know, Tom, it's interesting. We talk about the normalization of these values, and I think this is really interesting as cultures change. But you think back to, you know, Orange is the New Black, which is one of the most popular shows on Netflix. There's a transgender character there. So the same thing that what the Cosby Show did for African Americans that a lot of people said paved the way for Obama to be elected president, because seeing a middle class Black African-American professional became normal in some people's minds. You know, gay characters over, you know, Will and Grace and, you know, the litany of sitcoms that had gay characters for the past 20 years led to that. Now the next stage is to see transgender characters come into media, to see Diane Sawyer, to see the mainstream culture start to undertake this. and put a vocabulary to it, put faces to it, so that it doesn't become this exotic anymore.
The biggest hit Amazon Instant Streaming had in the U.S., won an Emmy, was Transparent, where Jeffrey Tambor played an older man who comes to terms with the fact that he is transgender as he is retiring, which is exactly the Bruce Jenner story in that case.
Mm. In France, we had we voted on gay marriage last year or maybe the year before, and it was a very big debate in a way that I did not expect in France. I thought there wouldn't be an issue.
No, but the Catholics didn't like it, though, at all.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it was cute. I found myself sort of stuck in an anti-gay marriage. It was marriage for everyone, the way it was branded here. Anti-gay marriage protest a couple of times. And they were the cutest protesters ever. They were all, you know, they had their cute little cardigans and they were walking around with their children and they were, you know, very polite. And it was, and obviously it was a lot more important than that, but it was an interesting way of looking at this social activity. But I think it was voted on maybe last year, maybe a few months before. And so we've had on the first anniversary, I think, of the law, people looking at the divorce rate. And the way it was reported on was very matter of fact. Basically, what you were describing, Eric, it was, oh, well, apparently they get divorced just as much as straight people do. All right, fine, whatever. Okay. And that was it. And so I'm thinking the transgender issue is going to be the next frontier, probably. And yeah, it will be interesting to see how it goes, definitely because of the, you know, the signs are here in popular culture as well. But I'm curious, though, Eric, how is that issue or that question being regarded in Vietnam?
Well, so transgender is not, I think, and transgender requires a lot of money. And so in a country with the per capita income is $2,000, the option isn't there for most people to pursue this if they wanted to. So let's take transgender off the table. On LGB issues, not the T, this is one of the most interesting countries in Asia, because just last year, in the fourth quarter of last year, the Vietnamese parliament, they did an interesting legal trick here. They said it's not illegal now to be gay in Vietnam. And that is the first step that people believe will pave the way for the legalization of homosexuality in Vietnam, which would make it one of the first Asian countries to do that. And then on top of it, there is expectation that that will lead to the first Asian country to legalize gay marriage. And when I came here 3 years ago for the first time, we near our house, there was a freedom parade. And now, that may not sound that unusual in Los Angeles or in Paris, but here it is against the law for any group more than five people to organize without a permit. There are no such things as kind of spontaneous parades. Everything is approved by the government. Everything is approved by the police in advance. And so the fact that there was this open, you know, rainbow type of gathering, which really surprised me, but it shows you that in this particular area, Vietnamese society is very, very progressive. And when it comes to sexuality, it takes me by surprise, because in many other ways they're very culturally conservative. But on sexuality, on homosexuality, and even kind of heterosexuality as well, the culture and the government are both much more progressive than most people imagine.
So when you say there's no transgender, I know what you mean. There's no sexual reassignment surgery going on.
Correct.
But that doesn't mean there are not transgender people. They just either have to live in secret or they are simply not able to do the sex reassignment. How is there a culture of cross-dressing at all, even?
There is. There's a strong femme and emo culture here, particularly among, obviously, among young men. And it's very visible, and you don't have to be here very long to see it. People are not intimidated or afraid in the big cities. I'll say that. Let me just kind of modify that. Sure. In Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. In the countryside, I think just like in any countryside, the values become more conservative. That's the same in the U.S. and in France and elsewhere as well. But in the big cities, here in Ho Chi Minh City and in Hanoi, you know, people wear their homosexuality quite openly. And it's not, again, something that you're ashamed about. People don't, you know, I have several of my staff who are openly gay, and it's not something that people gossip about or say anything negative about. They're like, well, okay, he's gay. Okay, well, whatever. Now, what I'm talking about in terms of the kind of sexual reassignment and some of these transgender issues, in those, you know, to do the chemical treatments, for example, to kind of change the hormones requires a healthcare system that can support it, requires obviously the means to purchase the drugs to do it. And for most people here, 99% of the population, they just don't have access to the, to either the healthcare or sure. the financial means to do it.
You know, it's interesting. I remember watching The Butler, I believe, where there was a very powerful scene. I can't remember if they actually said the words or if it was me who imagined them, but basically the idea that someone in their lifetime went from the situation in the U.S., you know, the situation of black people in the U.S. before the war or even beyond that to a black president being elected. Now, I don't, you know, I'm not suggesting that racism has been eradicated. Far from it.
I mean, yeah, I would not go down that path.
Exactly.
Right now.
I mean, certainly with the police brutality issues that you alluded to, Tom, that would be not accurate. Let's put it like that. But going from that in, you know, the issues of racism and in the issues of you know, gender and gay and even transgender now that we're seeing those characters on TV, I think we have a tendency of looking at the world in a very, I don't want to say negative way, but thinking that things don't change. We look at things in one moment and don't see, we look maybe a little bit too closely to the world, and we don't really take a step back and look at things, how things evolve over even 5 or 10 years. And, you know, if we look at all of those issues, we have to admit that things do evolve, and maybe even a little bit faster than we thought they would. If you had asked me 30 years ago, do you think gays are going to be able to marry anytime soon? I would have said, well, maybe in 150 years, you know, but generations have to change. Maybe we need several generations, but actually it seems all we needed was one.
Well, your point about racism illustrates that point. We tend to want to think in black and white, like, well, racism mm-hmm. hasn't been eliminated, so it hasn't changed. When the fact is, as bad as things are in the U.S. right now regarding race relations, they are still measurably improved over the 1960s. There is no debate about that. It doesn't mean they're solved. Doesn't mean they're perfect. It doesn't even mean they're close to perfect. But I think one of the keys here is that the understanding of a subculture has improved immeasurably. There were so many stereotypes, and I hesitate to even use examples because they're so offensive, about African-Americans going back into the 50s and 60s that just don't come up. And if they do, it's usually in the mouths of someone who's being portrayed as incredibly ignorant and backwards. But they were common stereotypes in the 50s and 60s, things like what kinds of things people eat or how they dressed, et cetera, et cetera. And we're now, when you're talking about transgender, having that same conversation about, wait, you know, with transgender, does that mean gay? No, it doesn't mean gay. Does that mean you actually want to change your sex to be a woman? Maybe it does sometimes, but there are other parts of the subculture who don't. They're transvestites. They just want to wear women's clothing, but they still want to identify as a woman. And it's very complex for people who are unfamiliar with it to wrap their heads around it. But we're having that conversation now, which was a conversation that played out in the U.S. in the 60s and early 70s and has progressed now to where we are looking for eliminating those friction points regarding to racism rather than trying to understand that it even exists. I mean, there were people in the 60s claiming that there was no such thing as racism because, you know, that's just the natural order of things. You don't hear people talking about that anymore.
Yeah, you know, the U.S. culture is changing in many ways, too, that are permitting this to happen. So it's becoming a more secular culture. People aren't going to church as much. People aren't identifying as extreme religious or as religious as they used to. And people are actually redefining marriage, even the heterosexual context, that people are marrying later. In many ways, Patrick, you would recognize it as a European that there's much more cohabitation. You know, a majority of French and Swedes, and I think Europeans as a whole, cohabitate without marriage, and they get a pex. And that's happening more and more. Civil unions are happening in the United States more and more. So you're having this whole redefinition of relationships and families in a way that makes this conversation possible and acceptable.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think marriage was something important. But, you know, it's funny, and I don't want to... Okay, a couple of things. First of all, it's the case in the U.S., and it's definitely the case in France as well, and in Europe. I'm sure that the idea of race or stereotypes was very present even a few short years ago. I remember, you know, the brands of and the imagery on some products that you could find in the store would seem very offensive today. And that was commonplace even 30 years ago. So it has changed in France as well. And the second thing, it's just an anecdote regarding marriage that you made me think of. When I got married to my wife a few years ago, it's funny how my understanding, not my understanding, my view of couples kind of changed, because for me, it felt like we had entered a very serious, it was a serious affair, even though it was very natural. But when I look at people, you know, on the net, on comments threads or on Twitter, or when they're saying my girlfriend or my partner or my significant other, for some reason, and I understand this is weird, it's just me, but it seems to me as kind of child's play a little bit. It's like, well, you know, marriage is where it's at. Marriage is the serious thing. So it's just, you know, something funny.
You sound like an old man. You kids, get off my lawn.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, if anything, I think obviously everyone should be able to choose how they handle their relationships. But if anything, it makes me even more convinced that people who truly love each other should be able to claim the rights to get married, whether they're gay or straight or anything else.
And or not, by the way, too. That's equally important.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly, well. Exactly.
You know, and that's the big change in the U.S. is that people are being able to cohabitate and have civil unions with all the rights that come with that as well, in childcare. Sure. And, you know.
Oh, yeah. When I moved in with my girlfriend in 1993, it was sketchy. It was a little bit sketchy. My parents were sort of holding their tongues about it. Today,
was it?
You wouldn't even blink. Huh. Yeah, you don't even think about it.
Hmm. All right. Things move in the right direction, I think, is the... I honestly think that's the case. When you're talking about old people asking the kids to get off their lawn, and I think a lot of people think, oh, back in my day, it was like this and it was so much better. And in most cases, I really don't think that's the case. I think in most cases, things overall and even in most particulars were not better.
Yeah. The wider view you take, the better humanity looks, right?
Mm, that's right.
You know, we're not being leached anymore. Slavery is at an all-time low.
Yeah, but even, you know, people think that the world is more violent than it's ever been. And actually, it's the exact opposite. You know, violence is at the... Even though we do have issues with terrorism and we do have armed conflicts in some regions of the world, and I'm not saying it's going to keep on the downward trend forever, but... For, you know, at least until since the end of World War II, the number of armed conflict or of trans-border armed conflict has been steadily declining. The number of deaths in Western countries has been declining. It's there is more literacy rates. There is more less infant mortality. There's less everything. All of the indicators are in the green. And I don't think people realize that enough. It doesn't mean we should stop, that we've won and that everything's perfect. But sometimes it's nice when, especially in a show like this, where we talk about all of the horribleness in the world, usually or often, to realize that things are not that bad, yeah. I would say. And talking about things that are... I don't know how to qualify this.
Eric, it's actually, we're going to close out kind of on this theme of 40, you know, looking back over the past 40 years and kind of change and uplifting positive change. So we started on a rather grim note, you know, and we're going to end on a more positive note here. On April 28th, 1975, a tank crashed through the gates of the presidential palace in Saigon, officially bringing an end to the war in Vietnam. Now, this war is misperceived outside of Vietnam, particularly in Europe and in the United States. The war in the United States was always the Vietnam War. This was a war between the Americans and the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese do not consider this to be a war between the Vietnamese and the Americans. This was a war between North and South. And what I find so interesting in this 40th anniversary of the war, which is really an important milestone for the Vietnamese, that they don't mention the Americans at all. There's really no reference whatsoever to the fact that the Americans fought here. Their emphasis is on the kind of reunification of the country between the North and the South. And the Americans were simply a supporting actor to the South, to the corrupt dictators in the South who the communists kind of defeated. That's their kind of line on this. And so what's happening here all this week, they're closing down the streets in Hanoi and in the downtown areas of Ho Chi Minh City, and they're going to have big parades. And this has never happened since 1975, the last time that the Vietnamese military was on the streets of Saigon. Was 1975. And here we have next Thursday, we're going to have a military parade. And people are enormously proud and very, very happy and very excited about this. And they're expecting 250,000 people to line the streets. They're going to have all the decorations and everything. And there's a lot of coverage right now going on in the US and European press to kind of look back at these 40 years. And the changes are just inconceivable. And I'll just give you one short anecdote. We went to the opening of a new mall in our neighborhood, which has a Starbucks in it, a McDonald's in it, an Adidas store, a BMW dealer, a Harley-Davidson dealer in it, a new IMAX movie theater, and they're promoting The Avengers, which is opening up on IMAX 3D. And there was Captain America in his, in his full uniform right there. And my little boy went running up to Captain America and waited in line with about 15 other Vietnamese boys to get their picture taken with Captain America. And you just That's could not amazing. Have imagined that 40 years ago that our two countries were in a brutal war. I mean, remember that more munitions were dropped on Vietnam in the war than all of Japan and the European conflict in World War II combined. So this was 3 million Vietnamese died in this war. 57,000, if I'm correct, Americans died. And yet here's Captain America, posing with Vietnamese children. And it's really remarkable what's happened. And just the last kind of key point on this is that the relationship between Vietnam and the United States now is really getting closer in many different ways. Next year will be, or this year actually, is the 20th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between the United States and Vietnam. Clinton signed into law the normalization of ties. And this year, Harvard University is going to be breaking ground on their only overseas campus here in Saigon. And this is, again, highlighting that the relationship between the United States is improving, not just on a kind of a political, but also on a cultural, on military. John McCain, who was a prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton for 6 years, is a very well-known figure here. He comes quite regularly, and he was the one who lobbied most aggressively to take down the arms embargo that the United States has on Vietnam. And so now U.S. weapons are being sold to certain kinds of U.S. weapons are being sold to the Vietnamese. U.S. Woohoo! And Vietnamese navies are cooperating together. Remember, my enemy's enemy is my friend. So,
okay, fair enough.
So everybody is fearful of China. And so that's why, China is really the one that's bringing the Americans and the Vietnamese together in many ways, because they both perceive a common threat. particularly in the South China Sea, or the East Vietnamese Sea, as the East Seas, the Vietnamese call it. So it's a fascinating time to think back over 40 years. I mean, here I am as an American running a news channel, which even 5 years ago would have been inconceivable in this country. And it's just, it's really very exciting. And this is a very vibrant, dynamic country. This is a country where a third of the population has a Facebook account. I mean, that is just a stunningly high number for a developing country. It's the fastest growing YouTube country in all of Asia. There's so many things that are happening, on so many different levels that you can look back over 10, 20, 30, 40 years to this anniversary of that tank crashing down the gate, and you just shake your head with marvel.
You know, I'm going to go to Tom, because certainly the anniversary of the Vietnam War, I'm not sure how it's being handled in the U.S.
Ignored.
Okay.
Entirely ignored. The anniversary in the United States is the departure from Saigon. It's the helicopters leaving the embassy. It's the pulling out of troops. Yeah. It's the remembering the defeat. We forget not only as Eric very, I forget until Eric brought this up that in Vietnam, the war is a civil war. It's not the U.S. versus the North Vietnamese. We forget that China was involved. We forget the Soviet Union was involved. We forget that this was a civil war that major superpowers were trying to take advantage of for their own benefit. And I think this is a really important shift in perspective to think about, because here in the United States, nothing about it at all.
You know, it haunts the U.S. still to this day. And the Vietnamese haunt the French. Let's not forget about Dien Bien Phu as well. I mean, the Vietnamese took the French to town as much as they took the Americans to town. And there's not a lot of remembrance of French defeat in Vietnam either.
So there is none.
So the Vietnamese have a pretty good track record in the 20th century. But nonetheless, what's so fascinating about the Vietnamese is that you talk to them, and a lot of Westerners come here and they say, well, how do they view Americans or even the French? The French colonized this country for a century, and they were not nice colonizers. It was a brutal colonization that was here. And yet you talk to the Vietnamese, and they literally have no antipathy, any kind of hostility of any kind, and it's genuine. My chief engineer in my TV station, he's got three pieces of American shrapnel in his body. He fought at Khe Sanh against the Americans. And I asked him, I said, do you hold us responsible? He said, no, my daughter's at the University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire. I'm going to be retiring in America. You're just like, oh, my God, And he said something very interesting to me. He said, the Vietnamese have a unique opportunity, an unique ability to forgive. They forgive the Japanese who colonized them. They forgive the Americans, the French, even the Russians who were here for a brief period. The only ones they say they will never forgive are the Chinese.
Well, you look at examples of that. Just for any U.S. listeners, the Philippines have a great relationship with the United States. The United States was not always very kind to the Philippines during its administration of that country. And inside the United States, the South and the North still coexisting more than 100 years later. we had a very divisive and very violent civil war in this country. And people don't forget that, but I think they forget what that means, that we have come out of it as a very firmly united country, at least, related to what that separation was.
Yeah. Well, not to be outdone, I'm going to throw in the European chip in the game.
Are you going to talk about taking Normandy back from the English or something?
No, not quite that far off. I might have mentioned this story in the show before, but I remember a few years ago when I was in the first couple of years when I was working at Blizzard. Blizzard is a company that has a lot of different nationalities. A lot of different languages are handled in the business, so we have a lot of different people from different countries working in the same office. And I remember going down to outside the building, and there were a few people smoking there, and there were French, German, Polish, a bunch of different people. And we were joking around and having fun. It was young people, in their 30s or so. And at some point, one of us made a joke about some, you know, German Nazi or some, you know, World War II thing about Nazis. And we all laughed and it was kind of funny. And then, you know, we stopped and realized that possibly one of the people present, grandfathers, might have been actual actors in that story or might have died or killed in that war. And we sort of took a moment to take on the gravity of the fact that only, you know, 50 years later, a little bit more, we were all here, not only interacting, being friends, being active with one another, but actually being able to laugh about these things that are no laughing matter at all. So that was sort of, again, another one of those realizations that this is kind of an amazing turn for the world, for us, and that, I guess, again, things aren't as bad as we sometimes want to think they are.
No, I mean, things have improved in this country remarkably over the past 40 years, particularly over the past 20 years. You know, it really opened up. The country started really blooming with the normalization of ties with the United States. And now, you know, people are looking forward to TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And what's so interesting, we won't get into the whole TPP thing, but when you're sitting on this side of the trade deal, you look at it very differently than if you're in the U.S., where everybody is kind of concerned about the loss of jobs and, you know, and rightfully concerned about labor and environmental issues. But over here, there's an enormous copyright as well.
Yeah, that's
an enormous amount of
excitement.
What enormous amount of excitement of being able to kind of export into the U.S. for, you know, without any duties. So, you know, again, it's just as there's a lot of optimism about the U.S.-Vietnam relationship going forward. Some trepidation still. It's not all kind of roses. It's still a complicated relationship, as all kind of international relations are. But when you compare that 40 years ago to next Thursday, you know, the helicopters were fleeing from District 1 of Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon. It's remarkable to think what's happened.
All right. I guess that is probably a good place to end the show. A little bit of positivity.
Nice uplifting kind of point there, huh?
Yeah. I feel like it's important, and I'm sorry to end our positivity a little bit by saying this, but it is important to note that as we're recording this, there was a 7.8 magnitude quake in Nepal, which the news out of it just keeps getting worse as the minutes go by. Nearly 1,000 people now, their estimate, have died there. And the only reason I bring it up is not to put a damper on things, but to show that, you know, there's always some crisis, and this is the kind of crisis where humans are responding. Pakistan and India both helping Nepal already to deal with this earthquake. And those are two nations that don't cooperate on a lot. So, you know, not to think that we're ignoring these sorts of things, because this is turning out to be a huge tragedy. But even in tragedy, you know, humans' capacity to forgive and humans' capacity to help is actually much greater than I think we often think it is.
Yeah, it's not, you know, on this show, as I was saying earlier, we do talk about the biggest issues that the world and humanity face all the time. And it's not to say that they aren't real. It's just that, yeah, sometimes it's nice to look at a little bit of the good things that come out of it on the long run. So that's what we did. Another good thing is iTunes. When people go there and leave nice comments about this show, that makes me happy too. For example, Steve, a few weeks ago, went there and said, "Wonderful news podcast," adding, "Love the podcast and the different takes of world news that you can find from views around the world. Patrick does a great job of allowing others from different locations around the world to share their views on events. I think that sums up the show in a nutshell." Thank you very much, Steve, for leaving a 5-star review on there. We've been out for a couple of years and we've been back for 6 months. I think we're back on the saddle now. The show is getting where I would like it to be. So thank you so much for sticking with us. Thank you so much for actually contributing to the show. There are a number of people going on Patreon and contributing money to the survival. Well, not the survival, it's not in danger, but supporting the show. There are over 100 of you guys going there, and thank you so much for doing so. I very, very, very much appreciate it. The address, if you want to contribute, is patreon.com/thePhileas Club. You can do that as well if you think the show is worth something to you or to the world. You know, let's not look at things in a small-minded way. And if you want to have more wonderful stories, people, and entertainment, how about you go to those fine places that my guests are going to tell you about right now, starting with Ace the Tech, because he's first in the alphabet.
Okay, fine. I'll take it. Daily Tech News Show. If you like these sorts of issues with a technology spin, that is what we do every day. Monday through Friday, anyway. We talk about the tech news around the world. Patrick joins us most Tuesdays to talk about whatever's in the news that day and also give us a perspective from a different part of the world as well. So hopefully, if you're into technology, you'll check it out and hopefully enjoy it.
So do you think we're going to talk about the Apple Watch this Tuesday, or is it going to be old by then already?
It might be old by Tuesday. We didn't even talk about it that much on Friday because I hadn't actually received mine yet. Mostly we talked about the iFixit teardown, how they poured resin over the chip to keep people from reverse engineering it.
So I didn't realize you had ordered one. I think it would be interesting to compare experiences because I
yeah,
haven't seen
absolutely.
Mine as well. So maybe
I have it on my wrist right now.
Ooh, exciting. Or not. And most likely
I'm still not sure.
We'll talk about it at some point. Eric, what about you? If we want to hear more about actually two of the most interesting powers and the way they're moving in the world, China and Africa.
Yeah, so I do something called the China-Africa Project. It's something I started about 5 years ago to kind of document the kind of rise of China all across Africa. It's a topic that a lot of people kind of, you know, don't really pay much attention to until they realize how incredibly important it is. We podcast every week. Cobus van Staden, my podcast partner out of South Africa, he and I do two podcasts a week. So you can find us on iTunes. We're doing about 100,000 downloads a month now. So we're very excited about the growth of the podcast. Nowhere near what you guys are doing. So I got to kind of find out what the special sauce is from the pros here. But if you'd like to find us, just go over to iTunes, search for China Africa Project. We're also on SoundCloud, Stitcher. You can find us anywhere else, kind of where all your famous podcasts are found. Twitter's EOLander, EOLANDER, tweeting the top China in Africa headlines every day. And then we have 250,000 folks on Facebook with an amazing discussion going on, again, about all things China, Africa, economics, politics, culture, military. So facebook.com/China Africa Project.
Excellent. 250,000. That's nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, we're very happy with that.
Quite amazing.
It shows you amazing interest in mostly from Africa and then South Asia as well as in North America.
Excellent. Well, now you know where to go. Thank you very much to the both of you. You can find me on Twitter at NotPatrick, and you can find this show and others at FrenchSpin.com. And that's going to be it for us. We'll be back in a month for a new Phileas Club. Thank you so much. Talk to you then.